Well, very good. At this time, I'm perfectly willing to answer what questions I can. If I can't answer them, I shall try to evade them. And but I want to begin by simply telling you about a very interesting book that touches upon many of our discussions about climate change and global warming and whatnot. It is a book is a description of North and South America before the coming of the Europeans and what it looked like from a demographic and geographic standpoint. And it has some real surprises in it. I was surprised by the extraordinarily large population of the two Americas within it. So it's a very, very interesting read. So there was a question. Oh, you had one? Yes, go ahead.
Since the church is in accordance with evolution, at what point has man received soul?
You mean the historical moment?
Like, I never might have become the ancestor of the chimpanzee, but in that process of the chimpanzee becoming man, at what exact point does God say, you're man, us?
Right. I can't give you a date. There is a point. And in fact, I just read an article about what I suppose we could call authentic humanization, that is Homo sapiens. And it is being worked on by linguists because it, for them it was the nature and the emergence of language that may have been that point, at least for the linguist. There is a point, but we can't give you an historical date. Yes, back here, right in the back, Dan. Yeah, that is a very tricky line that you have to do. I'm not a drug counselor. I think at a certain point, you simply have to admit that those who are close to the person are not the ones to assist that person in that particular aspect. I think that the best thing is just to stir that person toward that which may allow him to become free of the addiction. And sometimes the support is as important after they come out of the program. And that really requires what Pope Francis calls companionships. Being on the way with someone else, being a companion to them. One of the worst things, and I ask people about what is the gateway to the use of drugs. So often they tell me it's a feeling of isolation. There are certain stressors about it. And that, I think, is a help. But, you know, St. Francis de Sales, who is the patron of this diocese, once said that unless you tell the truth in charity, there is no charity without truth. Now that takes real spiritual discernment. Yeah. Oh, yes.
So I really appreciated your work.
basic natural education, but there are some similarities perhaps rooted in our human nature. So I wonder if you had other thoughts about it.
Yeah, you're right. By the way, I'm going to introduce you, Greg. This is Professor Hitzhusen. He is in the Department of Environment and Natural Resources at The Ohio State University. And thank you for being here. There are addictions that don't require drugs, but they can still have the same effect, like material reality. I often ask people, how do you define success? How do you define a successful and fulfilled life? Is it stuffed with things? I know some people who, well, they used to call them pack rats, but now, you know, they just buy and buy and buy and pile and pile and pile, and I swear one day the whole thing's going to fall on them. But it's how we define a fulfilled human life. And that's why I think if we simply say the only wish is that everyone be happy. Well, happiness is not being defined by philosophers anymore. It's being defined by advertising. And if that's what you're seeking, if that's going to make you happy, you're due for a real crash. Now, this does not mean that you have to all become monks in order to have a fulfilled life. There is a sustainability of a life, and especially the life of the family, that has to allow leisure to read, to develop intellectually and spiritually. That has to be part of our economic reality. But we can be kidnapped by it. I have found in some scholastic settings, the competition becomes so intense that if someone comes in second, it's a disaster. I mean, second is pretty good out of 300. But it's things like that. Yeah, there are addictions. You know, all of us have habits. I had one once. And how difficult it is to break a habit. A Mexican once said to me, it takes a nail to drive out a nail. That is, you cannot get rid of a bad habit unless you substitute a good habit. And of course, good habits are called virtue. Bad habits, vice. But they do kidnap us. You know, think of the use of foul language when you're trying to break that habit. A situation comes up and you know that word is right back here, struggling to fly out the tongue between the teeth. And it really is hard. But that happens to us. And the cure is to pursue virtue. And sometimes that's hard. It does take discipline. That's why the good Lord has given us Lent. Thanks, Greg.
I wonder, Bishop, if it comes to the attention of the church that I think that the church, whether it's Catholic or whatever faith, I think there are people that are more and more people coming to the church protected by the seal of confession. And by that I mean, for some addicts, the behavior behind their addiction causes them to injure other people and injure themselves. And at least if I go to the church and I dump it on Father or the beauty of reconciliation, how does the church become prepared for that person who comes in the midst of their addiction, dumps, and yet the behavior remains the same?
Yeah.
How do we prepare ourselves to respond to that?
Well, a number of ways. First of all, I was told as a seminarian, and I tried to tell others, that although the clergy should be able to recognize a problem, they don't perhaps have the skill to correct it, but they should be able to refer. The second thing is that we can never get into a position where we say that a human person has completely lost all moral responsibility. If that is true, then they cannot escape their addiction. Because it does make, at some point, it requires a choice. So that we can never excuse all of that, but because of the presence of addiction, it is a mitigating circumstance. So that the response is one both of a moral call to conversion and a profound recommendation to seek the help that is required. And that becomes really a moral obligation for us to seek that help. It is very, very difficult. As someone was telling me, well, with heroin addiction, sometimes it can take 5 rounds of rehabilitation before they can beat it. So the last thing I think we need is an infinite patience. But we just have to continue. They are human persons. And God never lets go. So. To talking to each other. You know, everyone, I think, is quoting the political atmosphere. We've got to keep in mind that that is a little more typical of American history than we like to remember. I can think of the election of 1884 when Grover Cleveland was accused of having an illegitimate child, and the chant was, Ma, Ma, where's my pa? Gone to the White House? Ha, ha, ha. Or when James G. Blaine, the Republican candidate, was sitting there while a minister was actually promoting his candidacy and said, the Democratic Party is the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion. And the Republicans lost the entire Catholic vote. So, you know, there's been a history of this. What has changed is how easily it spreads. Now, I will tell you that our language is a part of our environment. Language can foul the atmosphere. And we have to be very, very careful about that. One of the things that I remember about my father is that I never heard him use an obscene or word or a swear word. Never. And if he ever caught us saying that, it never happened, but we knew the consequences. But and it's not simply language in casual conversation. Back in 1960, a study was done of the average vocabulary of a high school senior. And it was found that a high school senior had an average vocabulary of 50,000 words. In 1990, a similar study was done, and it was found that the average vocabulary was 25,000 words. Now, the loss of words is the loss of thought. and the ability. And I've noticed also in debate, it's no longer I'm right and you're wrong. Well, we can work that out. I can show you you're wrong. But now it's I'm good and you're evil. Boy, that can really poison the atmosphere. In fact, the presidential debates I looked at and I said, these are no debates. This is a sitcom. I don't know why they call them debates. The only excitement in, the television station is gone, is how all of a sudden the candidates started barking back at the reporters. That was a new twist on it. But language, I can't stress it enough. Language is communication, language is thought. And words do tell. How many of you were taught sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me? Don't teach it to anyone else, it's a lie. You forget the pain of a broken arm long before you forget the pain of a word that's sunk deep. So, here ended that sermon. What are there any other questions? Yes, back here, Dan. Yeah, well, being good is the goal of life for Christians. The problem is that being good takes sometimes work and sometimes a struggle. Now, obviously, we'd rather feel good than feel bad. But the good feeling that really assists us is a feeling that emerges from accomplishment. Or a sense of being in the proper place. I like to call it well-being rather than good feeling. And it's something we work at because we have to be honest about what we can do and what we can't do. I don't know if you've noticed in our world, so often a vast number of people, in fact, I would call it the major culture, works between presumption and despair. The presumption is they believe they can correct it. I think ultimately they believe they can perfect the human person. But when all their programs fall apart because they haven't been aware of the great law of unintended consequences, so often they throw their hands up in the air. There's nothing we can do. Christians work between humility and hope. Humility in that we can't do everything, but we can do something, and sometimes it's right in front of our face. But we all know that before the coming of the kingdom, it's always going to be more or less. So we continue. We continue to look for the good, to do that which we can, to be thankful for the opportunities we have, and also to utter from time to time that necessary word, I'm sorry, to admit mistakes, and realize we can begin again. So it's really the goal, being good. And of course, for Christians, the model of perfect humanity is Jesus Christ. And that is the goal to which we go. And it's not a competition with other Christians. It's actually a desire for excellence. And the excellence that we see. Okay? Thank you, yeah. Okay. Oh, okay, we have one right here. Oh, a double-decker.
being happy is caused by environmental factors, but being joy is the state of mind and the state of heart.
Right.
So I think that being good is more being joy is caused by environmental factors. Mm-hmm. So another way of saying that, you can be happy, but you can't be joyous, but you cannot be happy while being joyous.
Right.
It's like all squares of parallelograms.
Very good, it's a square, yes. Right. Well, or just say these are going to be the consequences to the behavior. God exists outside of time, and in fact, there are three very difficult questions in Christian life. If in fact you ever write a book solving them, I swear it'll be coterminous with the coming of Jesus Christ a second time. One is the relationship between God's omnipotence and our freedom. And we know both exist, but how they connect, there's never been a complete answer given. But in fact, what I think the message of Fatima is, if you continue to live this way, these are the consequences. And it doesn't a prophetic insight to understand that. Isn't that what we tell other people? You know, if you continue to drink in those amounts, you're going to destroy your liver. Well, if the continual drinking continues and the liver does fall apart, that's not because I'm a prophet. I know the consequences. But it wasn't only Fatima who predicted that. It was Friedrich Nietzsche who predicted the World War. And he came from nothing, well, from a belief in nothing. So, yeah. Aha, back here. I know it. Guilty. Well, there are many things to keep in mind. First of all, we have to be a place, and I don't mean just a particular parish or whatnot, but we have to be a place where people who need that help can seek it. We also have to be honest that perhaps I, although you're the first person to talk to, am not able to offer you the help, but at least I can walk you to it. A third part of it is that we have to establish relationships that are close enough where things like that can be shared both candidly and without fear of repercussions. Now, this is difficult to have that relationship. We often call it the confessional, where that is. But in our own society, have you noticed that we've overlooked a very important difference between formality, informality, and intimacy? All of a sudden, everyone is supposed to be your best friend, no matter where you meet them. And that has created some real false relationships. I remember going into tellers. There was no lack. I said to the person who was helping me, do you realize that the only person in the Roman world that didn't have a last name was a slave? And she said, boy, you've got that right. But, you know, it's a profound thing. How do we become intimate friends? There has to be a place where it develops, where the trust grows. And that it develops out of our deep relationship with Jesus Christ through the sacrament, especially the reception of his body and blood in the Holy Eucharist. That creates, that common participation creates a relationship among all those people receiving it in common that is greater than any friendship or blood relationship in the world, because it is through Jesus Christ. Oh, good. Where is it? Oh, hello.
So, right. So they love it too. So it is, it's growing faith.
Right.
Gardening.
Right.
So I other
okay. Yeah. And it begins, well, it begins with gratitude. You know, there's a marvelous hymn that we often hear. It's entitled For the Beauty of the Earth. Have you heard that hymn? I think it's a marvelous environmental hymn in the 16th century. But I know, you know, when I mentioned the plastic tomatoes, my father could grow the largest tomatoes. And we had a great-aunt, my Aunt Mary, who was poor as a church mouse. But my father would always pick things from his garden and take them over to my Aunt Mary. As poor as she was always generous. She gave each of us kids both a Christmas gift and a birthday gift. It was a pair of socks. One sock on our birthday and the other at Christmas. And we used to call them our Aunt Mary socks. But my father would take over tomatoes and she would bite into it, and the look on her face made me think of seeing the beatific vision. Just that richness, that taste, and the deep gratitude that my father always remembered her. And it's from the earth, work of human hands, offered for a good purpose. That's the offertory of the church. So, well, thank you very much.